the flesh. Beneath the skin, the muscles stood out hard as stone. Prince Tommen was screaming and crying. "He's going to die," Tyrion realized. He felt curiously calm, though pandemonium raged all about him. They were pounding Joff on the back again, but his face was only growing darker. Dogs were barking, children were wailing, men were shouting useless advice at each other. Half the wedding guests were on their feet, some shoving at each other for a better view, others rushing for the doors in their haste to get away. Ser Meron pried the king's mouth open to jam a spoon down his throat. As he did, the boy's eyes met Tyrion's. "He has Jaime's eyes." Only had never seen Jaime look so scared. "The boy is only 13. Joffrey was making a dry, clacking noise, trying to speak. His eyes bulged white with terror, and he lifted a hand, reaching for his uncle or pointing. "Is he begging my forgiveness, or does he think I can save him?" "No!" Cersei wailed. "Father, help him! Someone help him! My son! My son!" Tyrion found himself thinking of Robb Stark. "My own wedding is looking much better in hindsight." He looked to see how Sansa was taking this, but there was so much confusion in the hall that he could not find her. But his eyes fell on the wedding chalice, forgotten on the floor. He went and scooped it up. There was still a half inch of deep purple wine in the bottom of it. Tyrion considered it for a moment, then poured it on the floor. Margaery Tyrell was weeping in her grandmother's arms as the old lady said, "Be brave, be brave." Most of the musicians had fled, but one last flautist in the gallery was blowing a dirge. In the rear of the throne room, scuffling had broken out around the doors, and the guests were trampling on each other. Sir Adam's gold cloaks moved in to restore order. Guests were rushing headlong out into the night, some weeping, some stumbling and retching, others white with fear. It occurred to Tyrion belatedly that it might be wise to leave himself. When he heard Cersei scream, he knew that it was over. "I should leave. Now." Instead, he waddled toward her. His sister sat in a puddle of wine, cradling her son's body. Her gown was torn and stained, her face white as chalk. A thin black dog crept up beside her, sniffing at Joffrey's corpse.
"The boy is gone, Cersei," Lord Tywin said.
He put his gloved hand on his daughter's shoulder as one of his guardsmen shooed away the dog.
"Unhand him now. Let him go."
She did not hear. It took two King's Guard to pry loose her fingers, so the body of King Joffrey Baratheon could slide limp and lifeless to the floor. The High Septon knelt beside him.
"Father above, judge our good King Joffrey justly," he intoned, beginning the prayer for the dead.
Margaery Tyrell began to sob, and Tyrion heard her mother, Lady Illyria, say,
"He choked, sweet king. He choked on the pie. It was naught to do with you. He choked. We all saw."
"He did not choke." Cersei's voice was sharp as Sir Ilion's sword. "My son was poisoned." She looked to the white knight standing helplessly around her. "Kingsguard, do your duty."
"My lady," said Sir Loras Tyrell, uncertain.
"Arrest my brother," she commanded him. "He did this, the dwarf, him, and his little wife. They killed my son, your king. Take them. Take them both." Sansa. Far across the city, a bell began to toll. Sansa felt as though she were in a dream. "Joffrey is dead," she told the trees, to see if that would wake her. He had not been dead when she left the throne room. He had been on his knees, though, clawing at his throat,
tearing at his own skin as he fought to breathe. The sight of it had been too terrible to watch, and she had turned and fled, sobbing. Lady Tanda had been fleeing as well.
"You have a good heart, my lady," she said to Sansa. "Not every maid would weep so for a man who set her aside and wed her to a dwarf."
"A good heart? I have a good heart?" Hysterical laughter rose up in her gullet, but Sansa choked it back down. The bells were ringing slow and mournful. Ringing, ringing, ringing. They had rung for King Robert the same way. Joffrey was dead. He was dead. He was dead, dead, dead. Why was she crying? When she wanted to dance. Were they tears of joy? She found her clothes where she had hidden them, the night before last, with no maids to help her. It took her longer than it should have to undo the laces of her gown. Her hands were strangely clumsy, though she was not as frightened as she ought to have been.
"The gods are cruel to take him so young and handsome at his own wedding feast," Lady Tanda had said to her.
"The gods are just," thought Sansa. Rob had died at a wedding feast as well. It was Rob she wept for. Him and Margaery. Poor Margaery, twice wed and twice widowed. Sansa slid her arm from a sleeve, pushed down the gown, and wriggled out of it. She balled it up and shoved it into the bole of an oak, shook out the clothing she had hidden there. "Dress warmly," Sir Dontus had told her, "and dress dark." She had no blacks, so she chose a dress of thick brown wool. The bodice was decorated with freshwater pearls, though. "The cloak will cover them." The cloak was a deep green with a large hood. She slipped the dress over her head and donned the cloak, though she left the hood down for the moment. There were shoes as well, simple and sturdy, with flat heels and square toes. "The gods heard my prayer," she thought. She felt so numb and dreamy. "My skin has turned to porcelain, to ivory, to steel." Her hands moved stiffly, awkwardly, as if they had never let down her hair before. For a moment she wished Shay was there to help her with the net. When she pulled it free, her long auburn hair cascaded down her back and across her shoulders. The web of spun silver hung from her fingers, the fine metal glimmering softly, the stones black in the moonlight. Black amethysts from a Shay. One of them was missing. Sansa lifted the net for a closer look. There was a dark smudge in the silver socket where the stone had fallen out. A sudden terror filled her. Her heart hammered against her ribs, and for an instant she held her breath. "Why am I so scared? It's only an amethyst. A black amethyst from a Shai, no more than that. It must have been loose in the setting, that's all. It was loose, and it fell out, and now it's lying somewhere in the throne room or in the yard. Unless—" Sir Dontus had said the hairnet was magic, that it would take her home. He told her that she must wear it tonight at Joffrey's wedding feast. The silver wire stretched tight across her knuckles. Her thumb rubbed back and forth against the hole where the stone had been. She tried to stop, but her fingers were not her own. Her thumb was drawn to the hole as the tongue is drawn to a missing tooth. What kind of magic? The king was dead, the cruel king who had been her gallant prince 1,000 years ago. If Dontus had lied about the hairnet, had he lied about the rest as well? What if he never comes? What if there's no ship, no boat on the river, no escape? What would happen to her then? She heard a faint rustle of leaves, and stuffed the silver hairnet down deep in the pocket of her cloak. "Who is there?" she cried. "Who is it?" The godswood was dim and dark, and the bells were ringing Joff into his grave. "Me." He staggered out from under the trees, reeling drunk. He caught her arm to steady himself. "Sweet Junkle, I've come. Your Florian has come. Don't be afraid." Sansa pulled away from his touch. "You said I must wear the hairnet. The silver net with the—" "What sort of stones are those?" amethyst. Black amethyst from Ashai, my lady. They're no amethysts. Are they? Are they? You lied. Black amethysts, he swore. There was magic in them. There was murder in them. Softly, my lady, softly. No murder. He choked on his pigeon pie. Duntus chortled. Oh, tasty, tasty pie, silver and stones. That's all it was. Silver and stone and magic.
The bells were tolling, and the wind was making a noise, like he had made, as he tried to suck a breath of air.
You poisoned him. You did. You took a stone for my hair.
Hush! You'll be the death of us. I did nothing. Come, we must away. They'll search for you. Your husband's been arrested.
Tyrion? She said, shocked.
Do you have another husband? The imp, the dwarf uncle. She thinks he did it.
He grabbed her hand and pulled at her.
This way. We must away. Quickly now. Have no fear.
Sansa followed, unresisting. I can never abide the weeping of women, Joff once said, but his mother was the only woman weeping now. In old Nan stories, the Grumpkins crafted magic things that could make a wish come true. Did I wish him dead? She wondered before she remembered that she was too old to believe in Grumpkins. Tyrion poisoned him. Her dwarf husband had hated his nephew, she knew. Could he truly have killed him? Did he know about my hairnet? About the black amethyst? He brought Joff wine. How could you make someone choke by putting an amethyst in their wine? If Tyrion did it, they will think I was part of it as well, she realized with a start of fear.
How not?
They were man and wife, and Joffrey had killed her father and mocked her with her brother's death. One flesh, one heart, one soul.
Be quiet now, my sweetling, said Dontus. Outside the Godswood, we must make no sound. Pull up your hood and hide your face.
Sansa nodded and did as he said. He was so drunk that sometimes Sansa had to lend him her arm to keep him from falling. The bells were ringing out across the city, more and more of them joining in. She kept her head down and stayed in the shadows, close behind Dontus. While descending the serpentine steps, he stumbled to his knees and retched. My poor Florian, she thought, as he wiped his mouth with a floppy sleeve. Dress dark, he'd said. Yet under his brown hooded cloak, he was wearing his old surcoat, red and pink horizontal stripes, beneath a black chief bearing three gold crowns, the arms of House Hollard. Why are you wearing your surcoat? Joff decreed it was death if you were caught dressed as a knight again. Nothing Joff had decreed mattered any longer.
I wanted to be a knight. For this, at least.
Dunters lurched back to his feet and took her arm.
Come, be quiet now. No questions.
They continued down the serpentine and across a small, sunken courtyard. Sir Dontus shoved open a heavy door and lit a taper. They were inside a long gallery. Along the wall stood empty suits of armour, dark and dusty, their helms crested with rows of scales that continued down their backs. As they hurried past, the taper's light made the shadows of each scale stretch and twist. The Hollow Knights are turning into dragons, she thought. One more stair took them to an oaken door banded with iron.
Be strong now, my gentle. You're almost there.
When Dontus lifted the bar and pulled open the door, Sansa felt the cold breeze on her face. She passed through 12 feet of wall, and then she was outside the castle, standing on the top of the cliff. Below was the river, above the sky, and one was as black as the other.
"We must climb down," Sir Dontus said. "At the bottom,
A man is waiting to row us out to the ship.
I'll fall. Bran had fallen, and he had loved to climb.
No, you won't. There's a sort of ladder, a secret ladder, carved into the stone. Here, you can feel it, my lady.
He got down on his knees with her and made her lean over the edge of the cliff, groping with her fingers until she found a handhold cut into the face of the bluff.
Almost as good as rungs.
Even so, it was a long way down.
I can't. You must.
Isn't there another way?
This is the way. It won't be so hard for a strong young girl like you. Hold on tight and never look down, and you'll be at the bottom in no time at all.
His eyes were shiny.
Your poor Florian is fat and old and drunk. I'm the one should be afraid. I used to fall off my horse, don't you remember? That was how we began. I was drunk and fell off my horse, and Geoffrey wanted my full head, but you saved me. You saved me, sweetly.
He's weeping, she realized. And now you have saved me.
Only if you go. If not, I have killed us both.
It was him, she thought. He killed Geoffrey. She had to go, for him as much as herself. You go first, sir. If he did fall, she did not want him falling down on her head and knocking them both off the cliff.
As you wish, my lady.
He gave her a sloppy kiss and swung his legs clumsily over the precipice, kicking about until he found a foothold.
Let me get down a bit and come after. You will come now. You must. Swear it.
I'll come, she promised. Sir Dantas disappeared. She could hear him huffing and puffing as he began the descent. Sansa listened to the tolling of the bell, counting each ring. At 10, gingerly, she eased herself over the edge of the cliff, poking with her toes until they found a place to rest. The castle walls loomed large above her, and for a moment she wanted nothing so much as to pull herself up and run back to her warm rooms in the kitchen keep. Be brave, she told herself, be brave, like a lady in a song. Sansa dared not look down. She kept her eyes on the face of the cliff, making certain of each step before reaching for the next. The stone was rough and cold. Sometimes she could feel her finger slipping, and the handholds were not as evenly spaced as she would have liked. The bells would not stop ringing. Before she was halfway down, her arms were trembling, and she knew she was going to fall. One more step, she told herself. One more step. She had to keep moving. If she stopped, she would never start again, and dawn would find her still clinging to the cliff, frozen in fear. One more step, and one more step. The ground took her by surprise. She stumbled and fell, her heart pounding. When she rolled onto her back and stared up at from where she had come, her head swam dizzily and her fingers clawed at the dirt. I did it. I did it. I didn't fall. I made the climb, and now I'm going home. Sir Dantas pulled her back onto her feet.
This way, quiet now, quiet, quiet.
He stayed close to the shadows that lay black and thick beneath the cliffs. Thankfully, they did not have to go far. 50 yards downriver, a man sat in a small skiff, half hidden by the remains of a great galley that had gone aground there and burned. Dantas limped up to him, puffing.
Oswell, no names,
the man said.
In the boat.
He sat hunched over his oars, an old man, tall and gangling, with long white hair and a great hooked nose, with eyes shaded by a cowl.
Get in, and be quick about it, he muttered. We need to be away.
When both of them were safe aboard, the cowled man slid the blades into the water and put his back into the oars, rowing them out toward the channel. Behind them the bells were still tolling the boy king's death. they had the dark river all to themselves. With slow, steady, rhythmic strokes, they threaded their way downstream, sliding above the sunken galleys, past broken masts, burned hulls and torn sails. The oarlocks had been muffled, so they moved almost soundlessly. A mist was rising over the water. Sansa saw the embattled ramparts of one of the imp's winch towers looming above. But the great chain had been lowered, and they rowed unimpeded past the spot where 1,000 men had burned. The shore fell away. The fog grew thicker. The sound of the bells began to fade. Finally, even the lights were gone, lost somewhere behind them. They were out in Blackwater Bay, and the world shrank to dark water, blowing mist, and their silent companion stooped over the oars. "How far must we go?" she asked.
"No talk."
The oarsman was old, but stronger than he looked, and his voice was fierce. There was something oddly familiar about his face, though Sansa could not say what it was.
"Not far."
Sir Dontus took her hand in his own and rubbed it gently.
"Your friend is there, waiting for you." "No talk,"
the oarsman growled again.
"Sound carries over water, sir fool."
Abashed, Sansa bit her lip and huddled on in silence. The rest was rowing, rowing, rowing. The eastern sky was vague with the first hint of dawn when Sansa finally saw a ghostly shape in the darkness ahead, a trading galley, her sails furled, moving slowly on a single bank of oars. As they drew closer, she saw the ship's figurehead, a merman with a golden crown blowing on a great seashell horn. She heard a voice cry out, and the galley swung slowly about. As they came alongside, the galley dropped a rope ladder over the rail. The rower shipped the oars and helped Sansa to her feet.
"Up now. Go on, girl. I got you."
Sansa thanked him for his kindness, but received no answer but a grunt. It was much easier going up the rope ladder than it had been coming down the cliff. The oarsman, Oswell, followed close behind her, while Sir Dontus remained in the boat. Two sailors were waiting by the rail to help her onto the deck. Sansa was trembling.
"She's cold," she heard someone say.
He took off his cloak and put it round her shoulders.
"There, is that better, my lady? Rest easy. The worst is past and done."
She knew the voice.
"But he's in the Vale," she thought.
Sir Lothar Brune stood beside him with a torch.
"Lord Pretire," Dontus called from the boat, "I must needs row back before they seek to look for me."
Batar Baelish put a hand on the rail.
"But first, you'll want your payment. 10,000 dragons, was it?"
10,000. Dontus rubbed his mouth with the back of his hand. "As you promised, my lord."
"Sir Lothar, the reward."
Lothar Brune dipped his torch. Three men stepped to the gunwale, raised crossbows, and fired. One bolt took Dontus in the chest as he looked up, punching through the left crown on his surcoat. The others ripped into throat and belly. It happened so quickly, neither Dontus nor Sansa had time to cry out. When it was done, Lothar Brune tossed the torch down on top of the corpse. The little boat was blazing fiercely as the galley moved away.
"You killed him!"
Clutching the rail, Sansa turned away and retched. Had she escaped the Lannisters to tumble into worse?
"My lady," Littlefinger murmured, "your grief is wasted on such a man as that. He was a sot, and no man's friend."
"But he saved me."
"He sold you for a promise of 10,000 dragons. Your disappearance will make them suspect you in Geoffrey's death. The gold cloaks will hunt, and the eunuch will jingle his purse. Dontus, well, you heard him. He sold you for gold. And when he'd drunk it up, he would have sold you again. A bag of dragons buys a man's silence for a while,
but a well-placed quarrel buys it forever. He smiled sadly. All he did at my behest. I dared not befriend you openly. When I heard how you saved his life at Joff's tourney, I knew he would be the perfect cat's paw. Sansa felt sick. He said it was my Florian. Do you perchance recall what I said to you that day your father sat the Iron Throne? The moment came back to her vividly. You tell me that life was not a song, that I would learn that one day to my sorrow. She felt tears in her eyes, but whether she wept for Ser Dontus Hollard, for Joff, for Tyrion, or for herself, Sansa could not say. Is it all lies? Forever and ever, everyone and everything?
Almost everyone. Save you and I, of course. He smiled. Come to the Godswood tonight, if you want to go home.
The note. It was you.
It had to be the Godswood. No other place in the Red Keep is safe from the eunuchs' little birds, or little rats, as I call them. There are trees in the Godswood, instead of walls, sky above instead of ceiling, roots and dirt and rock in place of floor. The rats have no place to scurry. Rats need to hide, lest men skewer them with swords.
Lord Petyr took her arm.
Let me show you to your cabin. You have had a long and trying day, I know. You must be weary.
Already the little boat was no more than the swirl of smoke and fire behind them, almost lost in the immensity of the dawn sea. There was no going back. Her only road was forward. Very weary, she admitted. As he led her below, he said, Tell me of the feast. The queen took such pains, the singers, the jugglers, the dancing bear. Did your little lord husband enjoy my jousting dwarfs? Yours?
I had to send to Braavos for them and hide them away in a brothel until the wedding. The expense was exceeded only by the butler. It is surprisingly difficult to hide a dwarf. And Joffrey, you can lead a king to water, but with Joff one had to splash it about before he realized he could drink it. When I told him about my little surprise, his grace said, Why would I want some ugly dwarfs at my feast? I hate dwarfs. I had to take him by the shoulder and whisper, Not as much as your uncle will.
The deck rocked beneath her feet, and Sansa felt as if the world itself had grown unsteady. They think Tyrion poisoned Joffrey. Ser Dontus said they seized him. Littlefinger smiled.
Widowhood will become you, Sansa.
The thought made her tummy flutter. She might never need to share a bed with Tyrion again. That was what she'd wanted, wasn't it? The cabin was low and cramped, but a feather bed had been laid upon the narrow sleeping shelf to make it more comfortable, and thick furs piled atop it.
It will be snug, I know, but you shouldn't be too uncomfortable.
Littlefinger pointed out a cedar chest under the porthole.
You'll find fresh garb within, dresses, small clothes, warm stockings, a cloak, wool and linen only, I fear, unworthy of a maid so beautiful, but they'll serve to keep you dry and clean until we can find you something finer.
He had all this prepared for me. My lord, I do not understand. Joffrey gave you Harrenhal, made you Lord Paramount of the Trident. Why?
Why should I wish him dead?
Littlefinger shrugged.
I had no motive. Besides, I am 1,000 leagues away in the Vale. Always keep your foes confused. If they are never certain who you are or what you want, they cannot know what you are like to do next. Sometimes the best way to baffle them is to make moves that have no purpose, or even seem to work against you. Remember that, Sansa, when you come to play the game.
What game?
The only game. The Game of Thrones. He brushed back a strand of her hair. You are old enough to know that your mother and I were more than friends. There was a time when Cat was all I wanted in this world. I dared to dream of the life we might make and the children she would give me. But she was a daughter of River Run and Hoster Tully. Family, duty, honor, Sansa. Family, duty, honor meant I could never have her hand. But she gave me something finer. A gift a woman can give but once. How could I turn my back upon her daughter? In a better world, you might have been mine, not Eddard Stark's. My loyal, loving daughter. Put Joffrey from your mind, sweetling. Dontus, Tyrion, all of them. They will never trouble you again. You are safe now. That is all that matters. You are safe with me and sailing home.
Jamie. The king is dead, they told him, never knowing that Joffrey was his son as well as his sovereign.
The imp opened his throat with a dagger, a costermonger declared at the roadside inn where they spent the night. He drank his blood from a big gold chalice.
The man did not recognize the bearded one-handed knight with a big bat on his shield, no more than any of them, so he said things he might otherwise have swallowed had he known who was listening.
It was poison did the deed, the innkeep insisted. The boy's face turned black as a plum.
May the father judge him justly, murmured a septon.
The dwarf's wife did the murder with him, swore an archer in Lord Rowan's livery. Afterwards she vanished from the hall in a puff of brimstone, and a ghostly direwolf was seen prowling the Red Keep, blood dripping from its jaws.
Jamie sat silent through it all, letting the words wash over him, a horn of ale forgotten in his one good hand.
Joffrey, my blood, my firstborn, my son.
He tried to bring the boy's face to mind, but his features kept turning into Cersei's.
She will be in mourning, her hair in disarray, and her eyes red from crying. Her mouth trembling, she tries to speak. She will cry again when she sees me, though she'll fight the tears.
His sister seldom wept but when she was with him. She could not stand for others to think her weak. Only to her twin did she show her wounds.
She will look to me for comfort and revenge.
They rode hard the next day at Jamie's insistence. His son was dead, and his sister needed him. When he saw the city before him, its watchtowers dark against the gathering dusk, Jamie Lannister cantered up to Steelshanks Walton behind Naege with a peace banner.
"What's that awful stink?"
the Northman complained.
"Death," thought Jamie,
but he said, "Smoke, sweat, and shit. King's Landing, in short. If you have a good nose, you can smell the treachery, too. You've never smelt a city before.
I smelt White Harbour. It never stank like this. White Harbour is to King's Landing as my brother Tyrion is to Sir Gregor Clegane."
Naege led them up a low hill, the seven-tailed peace banner lifting and turning in the wind, the polished seven-pointed star shining bright upon its staff. He would see Cersei soon, and Tyrion, and their father.
Could my brother truly have killed the boy?
Jamie found that hard to believe. He was curiously calm. Men were supposed to go mad with grief when their children died, he knew. They were supposed to tear their hair out by the roots, to curse the gods and swear red vengeance. So why was it that he felt so little? The boy lived and died, believing Robert Baratheon his sire. Jamie had seen him born, that was true, though more for Cersei than the child. But he had never held him. How would it look, his sister warned him, when the women finally left them? Bad enough Joff looks like you, without you mooning over him. Jamie yielded with hardly a fight. The boy had been a squalling pink thing who demanded too much of Cersei's time, Cersei's love, and Cersei's breasts. Robert was welcome to him. And now he's dead. He pictured Joff lying still and cold, with a face black from poison, and still felt nothing. Perhaps he was the monster they claimed. If the father above came down to offer him back his son or his hand, Jamie knew which he would choose. He had a second son, after all, and seed enough for many more. If Cersei wants another child, I'll give her one, and this time I'll hold him, and the others take those who do not like it. Robert was rotting in his grave, and Jamie was sick of lies. He turned abruptly and galloped back to find Brienne. Gods know why I bother. She is the least companionable creature I've ever had the misfortune to meet. The wench rode well behind, and a few feet off to the side, as if to proclaim that she was no part of them. They had found men's garb for her along the way, a tunic here, a mantle there, a pair of breeches, and a cowl cloak, even an old iron breastplate. She looked more comfortable dressed as a man, but nothing would ever make her look handsome, nor happy. Once out of Harrenhal, her usual pig-head stubbornness had soon reasserted itself. "I want my arms and armor back," she had insisted. "Oh, by all means, let us have you back in steel," Jamie replied. "A helm especially. We'll all be happier if you keep your mouth shut and your visor down." That much Brienne could do, but her sullen silences soon began to fray his good humour almost as much as Qyburn's endless attempts to be ingratiating. "I never thought I would find myself missing the company of Cleos Frey, gods help me." He was beginning to wish he had left her for the bear after all. "King's Landing," Jamie announced when he found her. "Our journey is done, my lady. You've kept your vow and delivered me to King's Landing. All but a few fingers and a hand." Brienne's eyes were listless. "That was only half my vow. I told Lady Catelyn I would bring her back her daughters, or Sansa at the least, and now—" She never met Robb Stark, yet her grief for him runs deeper than mine for Joff. Or perhaps it was Lady Catelyn she mourned. They had been at Brindlewood when they had had that news, from a red-faced tub of a knight named Sir Bertram Beesbury, whose arms were three beehives on a field striped black and yellow. A troop of Lord Piper's men had passed through Brindlewood only yesterday, Beesbury told them, rushing to King's Landing beneath a peace banner of their own.
"With the young wolf dead, Piper saw no point to fighting on. His son is captive at the Two Twins."
Brienne gaped like a cow about to choke on her cud, so it fell to Jamie to draw out the tale of the Red Wedding. "Every great lord has unruly bannermen who envy him his place," he told her afterward. "My father had the Rains and Tarbex. The Tyrells have the Florence. Hustard Tully had Walder Frey. Only strength keeps such men in their place. The moment they smell weakness. During the Age of Heroes, the Boltons used to flay the Starks and wear their skins as cloaks." She looked so miserable that Jamie almost found himself wanting to comfort her. Since that day, Brienne had been like one half-dead. Even calling her wench failed to provoke any response. The strength is gone from her. The woman had dropped a rock on Robin Rhaegar, battled a bear with a tawny sword, bitten off Vargo Hoat's ear, and fought Jamie to exhaustion. But she was broken now, done. "I'll speak to my father about returning you to Tarth, if it please you," he told her. "Or if you would rather stay, I could perchance find some place for you at court."
"As a lady companion to the queen," she said dully.
Jamie remembered the sight of her in that pink satin gown, and tried not to imagine what his sister might say of such a companion.
perhaps a post with the city watch. I will not serve with oathbreakers and murderers.
Then why did you ever bother putting on a sword? He might have said, but he bit back the words.
As you will, Brian.
One-handed, he wheeled his horse about and left her.
The gate of the guards was open when they reached it, but 24 wains were lined up along the roadside loaded with casks of cider, barrels of apples, bales of hay, and some of the biggest pumpkins Jamie had ever seen. Almost every wagon had its guards, men-at-arms wearing the badges of small lordlings, sellswords in mail and boiled leather, sometimes only a pink-cheeked farmer's son clutching a homemade spear with a far-hardened point. Jamie smiled at them all as he trotted past. At the gate the gold cloaks were collecting coin from each driver before waving the wagons through.
"What's this?" Stillshanks demanded. "They've got to pay for the right to sell inside the city by command of the king's hand and the master of coin."
Jamie looked up at the long line of wains, carts, and laden horses.
"Yet they still line up to pay? There's good coin to be made here now the fighting's done," the miller in the nearest wagon told them cheerfully. "It's the Lannisters hold the city now. Old Lord Tywin of the Rock. They say he shits silver."
"Gold," Jamie corrected dryly, "and Littlefinger minced the stuff from Goldenrod, I vow."
"The imp has master of coin now," said the captain of the gate, "or was, till they arrested him for murdering the king."
The man looked the Northman over suspiciously. "Who are you lot?"
"Lord Bolton's men, come to see the king's hand."
The captain glanced at Nage with his peace banner.
"Come to bend the knee, you mean? You're not the first. Go straight up to the castle and see you make no trouble."
He waved them through and turned back to the wagons. If King's Landing mourned its dead boy king, Jamie would never have known it. On the street of Seeds, a begging brother in threadbare robes was praying loudly for Joffrey's soul, but the passers-by paid him no more heed than they would a loose shutter banging in the wind. Elsewhere milled the usual crowds, gold cloaks in their black mail, baker's boys selling tarts and breads and hot pies, whores leaning out of windows with their bodices half unlaced, gutters redolent of night soil. They passed 5 men trying to drag a dead horse from the mouth of an alley, and elsewhere a juggler spinning knives through the air to delight a throng of drunken Tyrell soldiers and small children. Riding down familiar streets with 200 Northmen, a chainless maester, and an ugly freak of a woman at his side, Jamie found he scarcely drew a second look. He did not know whether he ought to be amused or annoyed. "They do not know me," he said to Steelshanks as they rode through Cobbler Square.
"Your face is changed, and your arms as well," the Northman said, "and they have a new Kingslayer now."
The gates to the Red Keep were open, but 12 gold cloaks armed with pikes barred the way. They lowered their points as Steelshanks came trotting up, but Jamie recognized the White Knight commanding them. Sir Merin. Sir Merin Tran's droopy eyes went wide.
"Sir Jamie?"
"How nice to be remembered. Move these men aside."
It had been a long time since anyone had leapt to obey him quite so fast. Jamie had forgotten how well he liked it. They found 2 more Kingsguard in the outer ward, 2 who had not worn white cloaks when Jamie last served here.
"How like Cersei to name me Lord Commander, and then choose my colleagues without consulting me?"
"Someone has given me 2 new brothers, I see," he said as he dismounted.
"We have that honour, sir."
The Knight of Flowers shone so fine and pure in his white scales and silk that Jamie felt a tattered and tawdry thing by contrast. Jamie turned to Merin Trant.
"Sir, you have been remiss in teaching our new brothers their duties."
"What duties?"
said Merin Trant defensively. "Keeping the king alive. How many monarchs have you lost since I left the city?"
2, is it?"
Then Sir Balin saw the stump.
"Oh, your hand!"
Jamie made himself smile. "I fight with my left now.
It makes for more of a contest. Where will I find my Lord Father?
In the cellar, with Lord Tyrell and Prince Oberon.
Mace Tyrell and the Red Viper breaking bread together. Strange and stranger.
Is the Queen with them as well?
No, my lord,
Sir Balin said.
You'll find her in the sept, praying over King Joff.
You? The last of the Northmen had dismounted, Jaime saw, and now Loras Tyrell had seen Brienne.
Sir Loras.
She stood stupidly, holding her bridle. Loras Tyrell strode toward her.
Why?
He said.
You will tell me why. He treated you kindly, gave you a rainbow cloak. Why would you kill him?
I never did. I would have died for him.
You will?
Sir Loras drew his longsword.
It was not me.
Eamon Kai swore it was, with his dying breath.
He was outside the tent. He never saw.
There was no one in the tent but you and Lady Stark. Do you claim that old woman could cut through hardened steel?
There was a shadow. I know how mad it sounds, but I was helping Renly into his armor, and the candles blew out, and there was blood everywhere. It was Stannis, Lady Catelyn said. His shadow. I had no part in it. On my honor.
You have no honor. Draw your sword. I won't have it said that I slew you while your hand was empty. Jaime stepped between them.
Put the sword away, sir.
Sir Loras edged around him. Are you craven as well as a killer, Brienne? Is that why you ran, with his blood in your hands? Draw your sword, woman.
Best hope she doesn't.
Jaime blocked his path again. Or is like to be your corpse we carry out. The wench is as strong as Gregor Clegane, though not so pretty.
This is no concern of yours.
Sir Loras shoved him aside. Jaime grabbed the boy with his good hand and yanked him around.
I am the Lord Commander of the King's Guard, you arrogant pup.
Your commander, so long as you wear that white cloak. Now sheathe your bloody sword, or I'll take it from you and shove it up some place even Renly never found. The boy hesitated half a heartbeat, long enough for Sir Balin Swan to say,
Do as the Lord Commander says, Loras.
Some of the gold cloaks drew their steel then, and that made some Dreadfort men do the same.
Splendid, thought Jaime.
No sooner do I climb down off my horse than we have a bloodbath in the yard. Sir Loras Tyrell slammed his sword back into its sheath.
That wasn't so difficult, was it?
I want her arrested, Sir Loras pointed. Lady Brienne, I charge you with the murder of Lord Renly Baratheon.
For what it's worth, said Jaime, the wench does have honour, more than I've seen from you. And it may even be she's telling it true. I'll grant you she's not what you call clever, but even my horse could come up with a better lie, if it was a lie she meant to tell. As you insist, however. Sir Balin, escort Lady Brienne to a tower cell and hold her there under guard, and find some suitable quarters for Steelshanks and his men, until such time as my father can see them.
Yes, my lord.
Brienne's big blue eyes were full of hurt, as Balon Swan and a dozen gold cloaks led her away.
You ought to be blowing me kisses, wench,
he wanted to tell her.
Why must they misunderstand every bloody thing he did?
Ares. It all grows from Ares. Jaime turned his back on the wench and strode across the yard. Another knight in white armour was guarding the doors of the royal sept, a tall man with a black beard, broad shoulders, and a hooked nose. When he saw Jaime, he gave a sour smile and said, And where do you think you're going? Into the sept. Jaime lifted his stump to point. That one right there. I mean to see the queen.
Her grace is in mourning, and why would she be wanting to see the likes of you?
Because I'm a lover and the father of a murdered son, he wanted to say.
Who in seven hells are you?
A knight of the King's Guard, and you'd best learn some respect, cripple, or I'll have that other hand,
and leave you to suck up your porridge of a morning.
I am the Queen's brother, sir. The White Knight thought that funny.
Escaped, have you? And grown a bit as well, my lord.
Her other brother, dolt, and the Lord Commander of the King's Guard. Now stand aside, or you'll wish you had. The dolt took a long look this time.
Is it Sir Jamie?
He straightened.
Oh, my pardon, my lord, I did not know you. I have the honour to be Sir Osmond Kettleblack.
Where's the honour in that?
I want some time alone with my sister. See that no one else enters the Sepsa. If we're disturbed, I'll have your bloody head.
Aye, sir, as you say.
Sir Osmond opened the door. Cersei was kneeling before the altar of the mother. Joffrey's bier had been laid out beneath the stranger who led the newly dead to the other world. The smell of incense hung heavy in the air, and 100 candles burned, sending up 100 prayers. Joff's like to need every one of them, too. His sister looked over her shoulder.
Who?
She said, then.
Jamie?
She rose, her eyes brimming with tears.
Is it truly you?
She did not come to him, however.
She has never come to me, he thought. She has always waited, letting me come to her. She gives, but I must ask.
You should have come sooner, she murmured, when he took her in his arms.
Why couldn't you have come sooner? To keep him safe. My boy.
Our boy. I came as fast as I could. He broke from the embrace and stepped back a pace. It's war out there, sister.
You look so thin. And your hair, your golden hair.
The hair will grow back. Jamie lifted his stump. She needs to see.
This won't.
Her eyes went wide.
The Starks?
No. This was Vargo Holt's work. The name meant nothing to her.
Who?
The Goat of Harrenhal, for a little while. Cersei turned to gaze at Joffrey's bier. They had dressed the dead king in gilded armour, eerily similar to Jaime's own. The visor of the helm was closed, but the candles reflected softly off the gold, so the boy shimmered bright and brave in death. The candlelight woke fires in the rubies that decorated the bodice of Cersei's morning dress as well. Her hair fell to her shoulders, undressed and unkempt. He killed him, Jamie, just as he'd warned me. One day, when I thought myself safe and happy, he would turn my joy to ashes in my mouth, he said.
Tyrion said that?
Jamie had not wanted to believe it. Kinslaying was worse than kingslaying in the eyes of gods and men.
He knew the boy was mine. I loved Tyrion. I was good to him.
Well, but for that one time. But the imp did not know the truth of that.
Or did he?
Why would he kill Joff?
For a whore.
She clutched his good hand and held it tight in hers. He told me he was going to do it. Joff knew. As he was dying, he pointed at his murderer, at our twisted little monster of a brother. She kissed Jamie's fingers. You'll kill him for me, won't you? You'll avenge our son.
Jamie pulled away.
He is still my brother. He shoved his stump at her face, in case she failed to see it. And I am in no fit state to be killing anyone. You have another hand, don't you? I'm not asking you to best the hound in battle. Tyrion is a dwarf locked in a cell. The guards will stand aside for you.
The thought turned his stomach.
I must know more of this, of how it happened.
You shall, Cersei promised.
There's to be a trial. When you hear all he did, you'll want him dead as much as I do. She touched his face. I was lost without you, Jamie. I was afraid the Starks would send me your head. I could not have borne that. She kissed him, a light kiss, the merest brush of her lips on his, but he could feel her tremble as he slid his arms around her. I'm not whole without you. There was no tenderness in the kiss he returned to her, only hunger.
her mouth open for his tongue. "No," she said weakly, when his lips moved down her neck. "Not here. The Septons."
"The others can take the Septons."
He kissed her again, kissed her silent, kissed her until she moaned. Then he knocked the candles aside and lifted her up onto the mother's altar, pushing up her skirts and the silken shift beneath. She pounded on his chest with feeble fists, murmuring about the risk, the danger, about their father, about the Septons, about the wrath of gods. He never heard her. He undid his breeches and climbed up and pushed her bare white legs apart. One hand slid up her thigh and underneath her small clothes. When he tore them away, he saw that her moon's blood was on her, but it made no difference.
"Hurry," she was whispering now. "Quickly, quickly now. Do it now. Do me now. Jamie, Jamie, Jamie."
Her hands helped guide him.
"Yes,"
Cecy said as he thrust.
"My brother, sweet brother, yes, like that, yes, I have you. You're home now, you're home now, you're home."
She kissed his ear and stroked his short, bristly hair. Jamie lost himself in her flesh. He could feel Cersei's heart beating in time with his own and the wetness of blood and seed where they were joined. But no sooner were they done than the queen said, "Let me up. If we are discovered like this..." Reluctantly he rolled away and helped her off the altar. The pale marble was smeared with blood. Jamie wiped it clean with his sleeve, then bent to pick up the candles he had knocked over. Fortunately, they had all gone out when they fell. "If the sept had caught fire, I might never have noticed." This was folly. Cersei pulled her gown straight.
"With father in the castle, Jamie, we must be careful."
"I'm sick of being careful. The Targaryens wed brother to sister. Why shouldn't we do the same? Marry me, Cersei. Stand up before the realm and say it's me you want. We'll have our own wedding feast, and make another son in place of Joffrey."
She drew back. "That's not funny.
Did you hear me chuckling? Did you leave your wits at River Run?"
Her voice had an edge to it.
"Tommen's throne derives from Robert, you know that. He'll have Casterly Rock. Isn't that enough? Let father sit the throne. All I want is you." He made to touch her cheek. "Old habits die hard," and it was his right arm he lifted. Cersei recoiled from his stump.
Don't talk like this. You're scaring me, Jamie. Don't be stupid. One wrong word, and you'll cost us everything."
"What did they do to you?"
"They cut off my hand."
"No, it's more. You're changed."
She backed off a step.
"We'll talk later, on the morrow. I have Sansa Stark's maids in a tower cell. I need to question them. You should go to father."
"I crossed 1,000 leagues to come to you, and lost the best part of me along the way. Don't tell me to leave."
"Leave me," she repeated, turning away.
Jamie laced up his breeches and did as she commanded. Weary as he was, he could not seek a bed. By now his lord father knew that he was back in the city. The Tower of the Hand was guarded by Lannister household guards, who knew him at once.
"The guards are good to give you back to us, sir," one said, as he held the door.
"The guards had no part in it. Catelyn Stark gave me back. Her and the Lord of the Dreadfort."
He climbed the stairs and pushed into the solar unannounced, to find his father sitting by the fire. Lord Tywin was alone, for which Jamie was thankful. He had no desire to flaunt his maimed hand for Mace Tyrell or the Red Viper just now, much less the two of them together.
"Jamie," Lord Tywin said, as if they had last seen each other at breakfast, "Lord Bolton led me to expect you earlier. I had hoped you'd be here for the wedding."
"I was delayed." Jamie closed the door softly. "My sister outdid herself, I'm told. 77 courses and a regicide. Never a wedding like it. How long have you known I was free?"
"The eunuch told me a few days after your escape. I sent the men into the Riverlands to look for you.
Gregor Clegane, Samuel Spicer, the brothers Plum. Varys put out the word as well, but quietly. We agreed that the fewer people